Welcome back. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and this is Ruby Tuesday, where every week we talk to someone smart about the sports stories that go beyond the sports page. So I have a question for you. Now, if you're listening, you probably know this has been pre-recorded, but just play along here. Here's the question. Do you like sports conspiracy theories? Do you like actual sports conspiracies? Because I love them. I want to believe. I wrote an extensive long-form story on them last year. A story that saw me end up watching footage of the 85 draft lottery. You know, the rigged one. With a real-life magician. And this was just so I could see what David Stern actually had up his sleeve. Now, for the record, I don't think the frozen envelope theory holds up. But maybe the bent corner. Or maybe the marked corner. Anyway, in reporting that story, I visited today's guest, Brian Toohey. He is America's leading sports conspiracyologist. I think he might be America's only sports conspiracyologist. He's also the author of two books, The Fix Is In, which deals with sports conspiracy theories, and the new book, Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. Now, I've read Larceny Games. It's really intriguing. Definitely worth a read. Had to have Brian on. So, Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Patrick. I appreciate it.
So let's talk about Larceny Games. Now, back when we first met, and this was back in 2008, I remember that you were in the middle of filing Freedom of Information Act requests with the FBI for all of their sports gambling files. So tell me what that process was like. How many files you ended up getting your hands on, and how those documents inform this book?
Well, I got over 400 files.
400 files?
400 files. What happened was, and what was really the break, is I met a guy online, and I swear I'm not making this story up. When I talked to him, he said he worked for a secret government agency. And I believe him, because I've stayed in contact with the guy.
Is this Edward Snowden by any chance?
Not that I'm aware of. he was probably above Edward. He was a really interesting guy, to say the least.
Does he go by the handle Morpheus, perhaps?
No. But he wanted to remain anonymous.
Okay.
And he's not a member of Anonymous.
Okay.
But he wanted to remain anonymous, so I'm keeping it that way. Keeping up with his wishes. But he basically turned me on to the proper way to file these Freedom of Information Act requests.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, because I learned that really, you know, he said the FBI doesn't work like Google. You can't just say, give me all your files on the NFL, and they go, here they are.
Right.
You had to kind of learn the tricks of the trade. And what really opened it up for me was that there's a file designation number for a lot of files, like be it gambling, be it, you know, bank robbery or what have you. Different crimes will have different file designations.
Okay.
And he turned me on to the actual file designation for sports bribery investigations, and those are the investigations into fixed games, into point shaving, into fixed horse races, and all that.
Right.
So once I learned that number, then I could basically ask for files almost by name, if you will, but by number. So, I mean, I'd ask for, like, number 172001, 172002, and I went through all of them until I basically ran out of numbers, until they stopped sending me things.
So when you do this, are you just filling out paperwork, or are you talking to, like, a real person at the FBI?
A little of both. I mean, at first, it was just sending these requests in, and after a while, the FBI, I guess, kind of got tired of me, if you will. They assigned me a person within the Freedom of Information Act division, and she became kind of like my, you know, partner in a way. So I could send things directly to her. I could even ask her questions. And for people who want to file Freedom of Information Act requests, I say give it a try, because it's actually not as hard as you think. It's not as scary as you think. And you can actually learn a lot. There's a lot of different subjects that they have, you know, information on besides the sports stuff.
But. Right. Now, did you become friends with this contact, the FBI? Like, was she into, like, what you were working on? Or was she just, you know, just the facts, here's what you asked for?
No, we've actually become friendly to a certain extent.
That's great.
Well, I think she was happy dealing with me because it was something different for her to read.
Right.
She was so used to reading stuff about communists and things of that nature, you know, JFK files, that she was kind of happy because she has to actually sit there and read. I mean, she's the one really you and I both need to talk to because she knows all the names that were pulled out.
So she knows she's the one doing the redacting.
Yes.
Oh, like, yeah. Then you really need to befriend her.
Well, I know. I tried to ask her. I said, you know, you want to meet for lunch one day or something, and you could, you know, maybe let a few things slip. But she didn't go for that one.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe that's not the smoothest approach. But I don't. You know what? I don't know how you do that. You know, maybe Snowden would know how to get to those redacted names. But
A couple, you know, glasses of wine, and she here. Let me tell you this. Let me tell you that.
I think you need to work on your spy game a little more than that. But So let me ask you, what do FBI files and redacted ones especially, what do they actually look like? And beyond these files, you know, what other reporting did you do for the book?
The files, imagine trying to read a newspaper article and, you know, all the names are taken out. And every once in a while, a key sentence is removed. You know, how well will you be able to understand that article? That's what reading a redacted file is like. You have to try to fill in the blanks. It's like playing the old match game on TV, you know, fill in the blank and see if you're right. The only good thing is the FBI apparently doesn't think people can put two and two together. Because
really?
While names would be pulled out, what I'd run into is you'd have a file, say, from 1968, and it would say Kansas City quarterback blank, who threw for, you know, 220 yards, 3 touchdowns, and 4 interceptions in this game against the Houston Oilers. Well, obviously, you dig up that box score.
So they assume not only is it does not work like Google, but they assume there's no profootballreference.com that you can
apparently
go to and figure this out.
Exactly.
That's terrific. So they don't redact the stats. They don't redact the team. They just redact the name.
Yes, exactly. Not always. I mean, sometimes on like, certain files like this, you know, New York Knicks file that made all the big news with the New York Post and what have you, and that one, there was no statistics or games to look up.
Okay.
So, you know, there were names redacted, and I knew there were names redacted, but I couldn't say who it was. I couldn't narrow it down.
Right.
So some files, yeah, it was really easy, and other files, you know, some files I couldn't even make heads or tails out of. I have one file I know that deals with a fixed football game in Florida. And I don't know even if it's college or the NFL. That's how badly redacted it is.
Wow. Well, that must be a serious one if it's that redacted. Yeah. Do you get that sense when you read them, like the more redaction, the more likely there's something really bad here?
In a sense, yes. Because it's funny, these are files, a lot of these files are literally, you know, 40, 50 years old. And you think to yourself, you know, how important can this be that you really need to protect these sources and this information today?
Right.
You know, it's a football game. It's not, again, it's not like I'm asking for, you know, the secret files of JFK or, you know, President Nixon or someone else.
Roswell, you know, and UFOs. We're not talking about that.
Yeah. I'm asking for a file about, you know, Kansas City Chiefs football game. It's like, who cares anymore? But that's the way the FBI works.
Right. Now, well, by the way, you mentioned the Knicks stuff. We'll get to that in a little bit. That was actually in the news this weekend. For people that didn't see it, we'll explain it.
Everyone should have seen it.
Right.
Been everywhere.
I think a lot of people saw it. And basically it was Knicks players were either point shaving or giving inside information as a favor to their cocaine dealer. But like, and this was in the early 80s. But like I said, we'll get to that a little bit later. In the book, you cover almost every sport. I mean, there's football, basketball, baseball, soccer, boxing. There's even tennis. So two questions to start here. One, how deep does the rabbit hole go with all of this? And two, of all the things you came across, to you, what is the single fishiest story or the league or the game or the athlete that you find the most suspicious?
That's a good question.
We'll start with the general one. How deep does this rabbit hole go? After you did this, you know, how do you look at sports now when you watch sports?
Well, I cannot watch them in the same manner at all. Not after writing these two books. I mean, there's no way. I mean, I look at them strictly as entertainment, as if I'm watching a movie or a television show, and that's it. You know, so many people have sports consume their lives, and they get so into it that they're willing to call it "we" as if they're part of the team, even though they're not. I'm not that person anymore. And it used to be probably when I was younger, but no more.
So this kind of killed your fandom in a way?
Oh, totally.
Really?
Totally. Oh, yeah. Because I can't look at it the same. The thing that frightens me is with these FBI files, for example, they start basically in 1964 when the Sports Bribery Act was passed.
Now
And
tell
then you
people what
have.
the Sports Bribery Act is, for those who don't
Well, the
know.
Sports Bribery Act, it made it illegal, a federal crime, for someone to bribe a player, a coach, or a referee to alter the outcome of a sporting event. Basically, it made it a crime to shave points or fix a game.
Okay.
That it was all local. It was a state law. And some states didn't even have a law against this, if you believe it. But the Sports Bribery Act made it a federal offense. And that's what started the FBI
So
into looking at
that's
the.
where these files start then. They start with the Sports
Exactly.
Bribery Act.
And what the FBI did is they built a network of sources and informants across the United States. And these were the people who would give the tips to the FBI, and the FBI would then go and investigate. And well, after about 20 years, that network of informants fell apart. And the FBI didn't really bother to continue it. And at the same time, they were tasked with fighting the war on drugs, basically, by Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, so
And
that
so,
brings us up to the 80s.
and that's where it ends. And that's the scary part. It's between basically 64 and 84, give or take. In those 20 years, I have 400 files. After that, there's nothing.
So that
And
makes you
that's
more
the frightening
suspicious,
part.
not less suspicious.
Exactly. That's the frightening part, is where did it all go? Now, some of these files basically indicate that, like, the NFL tried to contact the FBI and say, hey, you guys get out of this. This is an NFL problem. We'll deal with it. You guys in the FBI go away and let NFL security handle it.
Wait, so they were saying, even though this is illegal, and the whole reason that the FBI, you the FBI, are investigating this in the first place is because it is a federal crime. Don't get
Exactly.
involved. Don't do your job. We got this.
Exactly. And that's why the NFL security, Major League Baseball security, all these security divisions, these leagues, are staffed with former members of the FBI, DEA, Secret Service, and local law enforcement. I think it's because they have their liaison with the old office, and they can actually get the FBI to and allow the leagues to supposedly do their job for them.
So
And which is
is
why I
that
don't think any.
really I hate to cut you
Go
off, but is that if the leagues are trying to do that and their security staffs are staffed with these ex cops, ex FBI, is that because the leagues are really trying to get a handle on these problems, or are they trying to keep them out of the public eye? Are they trying to avoid embarrassment?
My opinion, the conspiracy side would be they're keeping it out of the public eye. They're trying to keep these things as quiet as possible until they can't. Until something like the Tim Donaghy story breaks, and then they have to scramble and, cover their butts.
So, okay, you
I think
mentioned
that's what I think.
Donaghy. Is that the fishiest thing from everything that you went through for this book? Or is there somebody else or some other game?
I think that one of the most interesting stories to me is back in 1962, when people say, oh, geez, 1962, that's so long ago, who cares? But the NFL claims they've never had a game fixed ever by anyone. So you have to keep that in mind when you think about the story. Back in 1962, the owner of the New York Titans at the time, they became the Jets later, was a guy by the name of Werblin, Sonny Werblin. And he basically,
He was a
I'm sorry,
Broadway
yeah,
guy,
wrong
right?
guy.
Was he a
Werblin
Broadway
bought this
guy?
team. I should say it's Harry Weismer. Sorry,
Okay,
let me
right.
get
Yeah,
that
because
straight.
Werblin was like an entertainment Broadway guy. So, okay. So it
The
was
guy
a.
before him, Harry Weismer, I'm
Okay.
getting. He changed the name. But Weismer, who owned the Titans, he had previously owned part of the Detroit Lions, and he had previously owned part of the Washington Redskins. In fact, he owned them both at the same time. He's one of the few people to ever own parts of two NFL teams at the same
That
time.
was a different league back then, obviously, but keep going.
Exactly. But Weismer, what happens is he owns the Titans. 1962, he walks into the FBI's office in New York City, sits down with two agents, and he says, I know my guys through last week's game. I
Wow.
know. FBI.
You there?
What's your proof? And he's like, see?
Okay,
Yeah.
sorry. Hey, sorry. We're having a little bit of audio difficulty.
Okay.
So, no, it seems like it's better now. So go back to, let's just go right back. He
Okay.
walked into the FBI office and he says, I think my guys threw last week's game. What happens
Yes.
from there?
So the FBI goes, okay, what do you have in terms of proof? And Weismer says, just like pretty much everyone else with a fixed game, I don't have any concrete proof, which is why a lot of these things are able to get away with, because there is no concrete proof. If you fix a game, you don't write these things down, you don't write up a contract, it's a handshake deal, it's money under the table, and that's it. But Weismer says, not only do I know last week's game was fixed, he goes, but I know gamblers have influenced other games in both the AFL and the NFL.
Wow.
Considering the fact that, again, the NFL says we've never had a game fixed before. So here's a guy who owned parts of three teams, three existing franchises today, and he says, back in 62, I know games have been fixed. Now, the funny part is, because it was 1962, prior to the Sports Bribery Act passing in 1964, the FBI basically says, thank you, and they just file it away, because it's not their job to investigate that, because it's not a crime, as far as they're concerned.
So he was 2 years too early.
Exactly.
Wow.
And amazingly, the interesting thing on top of it is, at the end of the 62 season, he sells the Titans and he football entirely.
So he's just gone from the sport, never to be heard from again.
And he left it. And he wrote a book called The Public Calls It Sport, like 2 years later, and then shortly after that he passed away.
That is pretty fishy. Speaking of fishiness, one of the things that you point out, and honestly do a really good job tracing the history of, is just how crucial gambling was and is to the survival and popularity of sports in this country. And also how much organized crime is a part of that, or has been a part of that.
No,
is. So how far back does that go? And you say is, how important are gambling and organized crime to what is now, a multi-billion dollar sports entertainment industry?
Gambling, I don't think anybody who's a fan of sports really isn't gambling on sports. And I hate to tell these people that even if they're betting like $50 with their local bookie, they're funding organized crime, whether they know it or not. Sports gambling is sports gambling is the number one moneymaker for organized crime, according to the FBI agents I interviewed.
Even now?
Today, yes. Far and away. Because you have to remember, nobody knows how much money is being gambled. The last estimate that we have on sports gambling in the United States says anywhere from $80 to $380 billion is being wagered illegally on sporting events each year.
Okay, that's way – I mean, NFL revenues, and they're the top league, are like $9 to $10 billion a year. So
exactly.
That's sports, massively bigger.
Yes. It's three times – the low estimate is three times what the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the NHL made combined.
That's stunning. And that's just in America, right? That's not even worldwide.
Worldwide, the last estimate I heard was maybe $1 trillion a year, illegally.
So that's my jaw dropping right now on the other side of this call.
It should be. It's shocking to me because, people don't even, I don't think you can figure out how much money that really is and how much money is being wagered. And a lot of it is these people, everyday Joes who are throwing $50, $100 down on these games. But yet that kind of money, which is completely unmonitored in the United States, despite what, Las Vegas likes to say, oh, we're on top of it all, we can monitor all this nonsense. They get about 1% of all the gambling done on sports in the country. 1%. They're monitoring nothing.
I mean, I'm still $1 trillion. I know I'm stuck on this, but it's like, did we give $1 trillion to Wall Street in the bailout? I mean, that's like a huge amount of money.
It's insane. It's really insane, and that's why all these games are being fixed worldwide, is because that's so much money going around, and so much money can be bet on these sporting events that, you throw an extra $1 million down on an NFL game or a soccer match or whatever, and nobody will notice it, especially when it's done illegally, because there's nobody watching for it.
Well, let's talk about that. You say nobody's watching that. So you've got a chapter in the book about Tim Donaghy. Everyone knows he's a disgraced NBA ref. He was betting on games, including games that he was involved in refereeing. Now, federal FBI investigations took place. They claim there was no evidence that he called games in any way to help his bets, that he was not game fixing. We'll get to that question in a second. But before we get to that, and this ties into what you were just saying, Donaghy, to me, is an example of how these leagues always say, we, our security departments, we're keeping an eye on the money and how it's moving in on certain games. The Vegas sports books are helping us out. They're looking for unusual movement on the point spread, on the betting lines. They say it's in their interest to spot the books. They say it's in their interest to spot fixes and have fair competition. Yet when you talk about Donahue in the book, it seemed like nobody except a couple of gambling sharps seemed to have realized there was just something funny going on with games he was refereeing. And it wasn't until the FBI, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like it wasn't until the FBI got evidence of what he was doing during a wiretap in an unrelated investigation that this all came to light. Is that basically
that's
right?
True. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly true.
So,
and that's the thing with sports bribery investigations of like Donahue, University of Toledo, University of San Diego. They all started because of other investigations, and then they were tipped off about the game-fixing end of it.
Well,
but going back to the question about Las Vegas, you're right. Las Vegas, there were incredible line movements on NBA games. Where normally, because NBA games are almost nightly, you only usually have about a 24-hour window for the line to move. Well, if a line moves like 2 or 3 points in that 24 hours, it's pretty impressive to the bookies there. Well, Donahue games were moving 7, 8, 9, 10 points, and nobody said anything.
Wait, I thought they were supposed to, though. I thought that was the whole thing. We watch these lines. If anything's crazy, we report it to the leagues or we talk to the FBI.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is I don't know if they did. Because I think a lot of times it was some of these sharp gamblers who noticed this. Some of the guys were getting killed on these games. That's the funny part, is some of these sharp gamblers were getting killed on them because they saw value one way, then they would see the line move 6, 7, 8 points, and they would see incredible value then, and bet the wrong side and just keep getting killed on it and couldn't figure out why. So as sharp as these guys are, as smart as they are, as much as they watch this stuff, they didn't figure it out either until later, until he got busted for it. Then all of a sudden everything blew up and everybody had that aha moment, like, oh, there was something fishy going on here.
So if nobody's, yeah,
nobody's noticing it.
So if nobody noticed and they say this is what they watch for and they weren't seeing it, how much confidence should any of us have in the ability of leagues in Vegas to monitor this stuff?
I don't think you should have any. I mean, I do know. I mean, they are working together. I don't think that's a lie. I don't think they're just, you know, blowing smoke about that. They really do meet. Supposedly they meet once a year, sports books, managers, and, like, representatives sort of league. They meet, like, once a year to talk about this sort of thing. But, again, that's 1% of the gambling done in the United States on sports.
Right.
So, you know, what can you see? 1% of something is basically nothing. So you don't even know what's going on. I mean, the biggest sports books are in New York City right underneath the league's noses, and they don't know what's going on.
So,
I mean, it's kind of frightening when you think about that. You know, the leagues are – I'm sure they do want the appearance of integrity, but they really aren't doing much to enforce that integrity.
Well, I mean, gambling is, in a way – they say it's not in their interest at all, but – you know, as you point out, there's so much money in it, which drives so much interest in sports, which drives ratings, which drives excitement, which drives viewers, which is how they really make their money. I mean, it seems to me pretty logical to say they claim one thing, but in reality, they must know the other. I mean, when leagues come out and say, you know, we don't condone, we don't want gambling, we wish we could press a button and it would all go away. I mean, is that basically BS?
Oh, totally. I mean, they asked that exact question to Pete Rozelle back in 1985, I think it was on the NFL on NBC show. They asked Pete, they said, hey, if there was a button right here next to you and you could push it, it would make all sports gambling away, would you press it? And he really didn't answer the question. He didn't say, yes, I would do it immediately. He was like, well, you know.
He was a PR guy, though. That's crazy that he didn't answer it. A rare moment
of
honesty.
Yeah, but that's why, because they know. They know people are watching these games late into the fourth quarter because of the point spread. They know they're watching because they have money on the line. That's why, even that's fantasy football. I mean, that's why they promote fantasy football and fantasy sports so much, is because they know it keeps people in their seats watching the games as long as possible to the very end because it matters to them. And that's kind of the hypocrisy of the argument against legalizing sports gambling, is they say, well, geez, if we legalize sports gambling, it's going to turn all of these fans into, you know, gamblers, and it's going to make them watch these games for all the wrong reasons. Well, guess what? Fantasy sports is doing the exact same thing, and they don't care because, no, it's getting all the games until the very end.
Let's go back to Donahue. Like I said, federal investigation, NBA investigation. He wasn't calling games in a way to help his bets. He wasn't fixing.
He was doing it unconsciously.
Okay. He was doing it consciously.
That was his argument, yeah.
So two things. One, they made that claim. And two, the NBA also claimed that he was basically a lone gunman, the only guy out there doing anything shady. So on both of those claims, Donahue wasn't fixing to help himself, and he was a lone gunman on the grassy knoll. I'm sorry, I guess the lone gunman in the book depository. Grassy knoll was actually gunman number two. Do you think either one of those is true? Do we know the full? Do we know anything close to the full story about Donahue? What is your gut feeling on this after looking into it?
I think the real story of Donahue is in the book Gaming the Game. I think that's the one, and that's the one about the.
Wait. So hold on. So we had a little drop there. Hey, we had a little drop there. Sorry about that. So the book Gaming the Game.
Okay. Gaming the Game. That's probably the more true and accurate story of the whole Tim Donahue's.
Okay.
He's got more of the reality of what happened because he was talking to the bookie, and the bookie had all the records of what was being bet, what games were being bet on, et cetera, et cetera. And the truth is Donahue, he was hitting 80% of the games he was betting on when he was officiating them. Not just randomly, not because he had all this inside information on how, you know, the referees cared about certain players and hated other players. He was getting all the games right that he was directly involved in, not the other games.
Yeah, that's kind of a big piece of evidence. I'm going to agree
with
you.
It's a huge piece of evidence. But the thing with the story is people forget he turned himself over to the FBI, which allowed him to really control the whole story. The other guy, Batista, the bookie, he refused to work with the FBI. So the only guy that FBI had to go on was Donahue's story, and of course Donahue's story made Donahue look as good as he possibly could. So since he could control the story, it was very easy for him to say, well, I wasn't fixing games, I wasn't shaving points in any way, I was just betting on these games, and this guy was, you know, this bookie was doing what he was doing on the side, but I wasn't helping him. And the FBI went along with it. Of course, the hard part would be, is how do you prove that Donahue...
How do you prove that he fixed the game?
I mean, do you watch the... Yeah, how do you do it? I mean, they watched game film, but, you know, what does the FBI know about calling basketball games? And the NBA wasn't exactly helping them, because the NBA didn't want them to prove that they were fixing games, because then they had huge integrity issues, then they had problems about which games did he fix, do they have playoff implications, do they have draft pick implications, you know, there's all sorts of, a whole can of worms they were going to open up if he admitted to fixing games over the course of about 2 or 3 seasons.
Right.
So the FBI basically said, look, we got him on the gambling, we got him on these other counts, forget the game-fixing end of it. Plus, Donahue never admitted to it like he did the other stuff.
And like you said, it's almost impossible to prove a fix because nobody puts down a contract. You're not going to have a bunch of emails like talking about fixing. It's handshake deals. It's verbal. Maybe you could get a wire on somebody, but you'd have to already know what was going on. Just seems
very
hard.
And that's why the FBI, I think, kind of quit investigating fixes, because they had the issue themselves. If they didn't have a wiretap, if they didn't have somebody who outright admitted to it, they had nothing to base a case on. You know, as many gamblers could show up on their door and say, geez, I'm sure this game was fixed. We had all this strange money coming in. The line moved in a huge way, and the game ended in the favor of the big money. Yeah, that's great. And we know, even if they knew a gambler was working with a player, which they did in some cases, they like this New York Knicks thing, it didn't matter because it still wasn't proof of the game being fixed. And that's what they had to try to prove.
Well, Donahue, does he prove that the easiest way to fix the game is to go through the ref? Is that the easiest way to fix a game? I know you're not into gambling or game fixing, but let me ask you, if you had a gun to your head and it's like, Brian, I need you to fix this game or I'm pulling the trigger, what's the easiest way to do it?
I think the referee's the best choice.
Why?
Because he can do so much, either in basketball or football, even in the NHL. You call a couple of certain holding calls at a certain key time, you call a couple penalties, give a team a power play, you call really tight fouls and get one of the basketball players in foul trouble, and it alters the game. And that's one of the things I argue about in the fixes in when I talk about the fact that I think the leagues fix their own games or manipulate their own games to keep them interesting and to build certain storylines. They can do it through the referees and do it legally, by the way. Fix these games legally. The leagues can do it.
Wait, legally?
Yeah, legally. There's no law preventing the league from fixing its own game. None.
Is this some sort of WWE exception to the law, or there's no law, just period? What do you mean?
There's no law. The closest laws that protect fans from the leagues manipulating their own games, like the WWE, are the Sports Bribery Act, which indicates bribery has to occur. And if the league tells a referee like Donaghy how they want them to officiate a game, if they want to say, hey, make sure LeBron has more room to operate, give Aaron Rodgers, you know, a little more room to throw his passes, but call tighter penalties on this guy or that team, the leagues can do that perfectly legally. It's just an employer telling an employee how to do your job. There's nothing illegal about that.
Really?
The only other law that comes close to it is the quiz show scandal law. Back in the 1950s, when the television networks were rigging quiz shows to make them more interesting to the fans, the law that was passed because of that whole scandal specifically states an intellectual contest cannot be fixed for television purposes.
Wait, isn't the National Football League an intellectual contest? All I hear about is how complicated football is. And what about, aren't these all intellectual contests in a way? I'm not being sarcastic, by the way. I mean, couldn't you make that argument?
I understand where you're coming from. I'm sure a good lawyer in court could argue it either way. But I don't think so. I think it would be deemed a physical contest, a sport. And you got to remember, too, the leagues argued in front of the Supreme Court. The NFL argued in front of the Supreme Court. We are not 32 individual teams. We are one entity, the NFL, and we are an entertainment industry.
Much like the WWE.
Exactly. It's the exact same laws that would prevent basically the WWE from, you know, altering or fixing one of their matches, which we all know they're staged. Well, I think most of us know they're staged. The NFL can do the exact same thing. It could all be just one big act, and the, you know, fans have no recourse. None.
So going through the referee is the best way to do it. What do you think is, okay, if you're going through the referee, what do you think is the easiest sports to fix? And if you're, and conversely, if you have to go through an athlete, what would be the easiest sports to fix?
I think in either case, I think basketball.
Really?
I think basketball is the easiest one to rig. Well, if you take a player, if you have one guy on the team, that's 20% of the team. And if you get a referee, if he's calling tight fouls, he can keep putting one team on the line all night long if he wants to. I mean, I think that can easily alter the outcome of any game. Just there, 20% off of a team or plenty of fouls, no problem. After that, I think the NFL actually is easier to fix than most people think.
You think it'd be easier to fix than a baseball game, having the home plate umpire maybe manipulate the strike zone?
Yeah, because the problem with that is even though, like you say, if he's calling tighter strikes on one pitcher and, you know, allowing the other pitcher to get away with a little bit more, he still can't stop the ball from going over the fence if a guy connects with it. You know, he can't change that on a touchdown. Maybe there's a holding call.
Right, because there's holding on every play, right? You can always call holding.
Exactly. So I think, you know, it's easier for an NFL referee to do that. And the FBI files that I have, you know, there were investigations into NFL referees, and there were investigations into NBA referees, but there weren't any into Major League Baseball umpires.
Now, we should probably note, we're talking about team sports here. Obviously, as everybody knows, easiest sports to fix through an athlete would be the one-on-one sports, like boxing.
Exactly.
Look, boxing, there's a lot of fixing that has historically always gone on. But also tennis, which is something I think people don't think about. I wrote something about that earlier this year, and you write about it in your book as well. Not only is it like tennis a possibility to fix, it seems like tennis, the sport, is worried about that right now. What's going on there?
Tennis is incredibly corrupt. I couldn't believe it myself because I'm not a tennis fan. And I think there's people who are tennis fans and then people who really don't care about tennis whatsoever. But tennis globally is the second most gambled upon sport behind
the
soccer.
The second most gambled on sport is tennis? Not cricket? Not rugby?
Nope. Not the NFL, not Major League Baseball. Tennis.
I didn't know that.
Most people don't. I didn't know it until I ran across that stat. But tennis has instituted what they have, a tennis integrity unit. And they are supposedly fighting the good fight and trying to protect from all these fixes. The problem with tennis, like you say, it's like boxing. It's a one-on-one sport for the most part. So if you get to one guy, you got the match fixed. And what the scary part with tennis is there's a lot of what they call spot fixing.
What's spot fixing? For people that I know what it is, but for people that don't know, explain it.
Well, spot fixing, as opposed to like a NBA game where you want to fix basically the final result, spot fixing, which you can do in many places in Europe, and it's starting to be instituted in sports books in Las Vegas, is you can bet on individual occurrences. You can bet on games, you can bet on sets, you can bet on the number of faults, you can bet on in soccer, like if somebody gets a yellow card or not during a game, you can bet on all the little things within a game or within a match.
Right.
And what tennis is worried about is because there's so much money being bet on these sports and even being bet on these little strange occurrences within matches, that you, if you're working with a player, a tennis player, you don't have to get him to lose a match. You could just get him to lose the third game in the set, in the second set. Who would know?
And
But if
that's a
somebody's
lot
got a lot of
easier,
money
right?
on that, what's that?
That's a lot easier, right? Like you said, because maybe you've got a guy who's really heavily favored, or conversely, a guy that has no chance. And you're not asking him to go out there and tank. You're just asking
No.
him to, why don't you tank this set, or why don't you put in a couple double faults here, or maybe in soccer, why don't you be the first guy to get a yellow card?
Yeah, and how hard is that? I mean, will that change the outcome of the match or the game? Not necessarily. Perhaps not at all. But when you get to tennis, when you have all these lower-ranked players, I mean, even the guys who are 100th-ranked in the world, they're not making a lot of money. Even if they show up at Wimbledon and win a couple of matches, they're not making money. It probably cost them more to travel there than it did in prize money that they earned.
So unlike a
So,
Roger Federer who's making millions, they've got a lot of incentive to potentially do some spot fixing.
potentially, yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, some gambler approaches these tennis players and say, look, you're not going to do well. You may, win a couple matches, but look, it costs you whatever, $5,000 to get there. If you come in, 86th, you're only going to get $2,000. How about I make sure you get $10,000, and all you got to do is throw, again, like the second game in the second set. How
Yeah.
be? What do you say?
I could definitely see a temptation there, especially if it's a case where I'm 150, 250 in the world. I'm trying to live my dream and I need money to go to the next four tournaments.
Exactly. And that's what tennis is deathly afraid of. And they're trying to figure out a way to better compensate these players and to get them to the tournaments cheaper because of this fear. And it's a very real fear. And it's caught many people in tennis who have done it. And some would argue that actually they know of many higher ranked players who were involved in these sorts of shenanigans, but that conspiracy theory here, that they won't bust them because they're afraid of an outright just devastating scandal where a guy, someone like a Roger Federer gets busted for gambling on games and then the whole sport blows up.
Right. I think every league, every sport, A, doesn't want that to happen, but B, if that is happening, never wants that to come to the light of day. I mean, I don't want to harp on any particular sport because if I was in charge of any of those leagues, I wouldn't want that either. I mean, I totally understand that. It's not something I say lightly as a journalist, but again, if I was the commissioner of a league or the head of a tour or anything like that, I would never want that to come out.
No,
I would move heaven and earth to make sure it never came out.
exactly, and that's why I think it took someone like me to write the book I wrote, like Larceny Games, because I think a lot of the sports writers, especially the bigger sports writers who got more pull, are more willing to listen to the leagues and kowtow to their demands, like we just saw with, ESPN and PBS over the whole Frontline thing, giving in to the NFL's demands to not be a part of it. I think that's why, My Game on Game Fixing is the only book like this written in America in 25 years. Because it took someone outside of this whole sports world to do it.
Because you feel like that you've got nothing to lose in terms of a league partner, anything like that.
Yeah, they can't pressure me. They can't say, hey, we're going to, pull your access from a certain team or a certain league or whatever because you've written something negative about us. I have no access. So there's nothing they could take away from me.
Right.
I got nothing to lose. It's like, sure,
It's kind of the
I got a
deadspin
real
approach.
job. What's that?
It's kind of the deadspin approach.
Yeah, in a sense. But even Deadspin. Now, I mean, I know Deadspin. I approached them about one piece that I was working on, and they didn't seem interested in it, despite the fact that it was about fixing and this kind of whole conspiracy realm. They, kind of backed away from it, in all honesty.
Well, that's since we're talking about sports writers, this is a curveball, but this was an interesting thing that I made a note of when I was reading the book. If I'm a gambler, and I'm not looking to fix, but I'm looking for that inside information, which is still really valuable, even now with all the media we have, all the reporting we have, all the injury reports we have. the real inside information on what's going on with the team, still incredibly valuable. Is a guy, was he drunk last night? Is he having problems in his marriage? Is this coach like one foot out the door because he's already looking for his next job? Those kind of things that can really affect the outcome of a game. If I'm a gambler looking for that, am I better off trying to befriend someone with a team, or am I better off just paying off a sports writer who covers that team regularly?
It seems like the beat writer's the best guy to go after because he knows all this stuff and in many cases won't report it. Because again, he knows if he reports enough bad stories, he loses access to that locker room, and which has happened. I mean, people think like you just say that. No, it's true. Guys have lost access to locker rooms and lost access to players for writing the wrong type of story. So I think, many beat writers are really upbeat and really positive about their team that they cover in a way because they have to. But at the same time, like you said, a gambler who gets a hold of one of these guys, and some of these guys gamble. I mean, that's one of the things that came out and that came in the game book was the fact that some of these beat writers are gambling. They get in trouble with your bookie, and then what they
Oh,
do
right.
is they, I'll get some information on, the Eagles that might prove really handy to you. How about, cut me a little slack on this debt, and I'll give you some of this inside info. And, inside info is gold for gamblers. That's what they're looking for. They scrape around for this stuff. They dig up everything they can to make the most informed bet they can. And a beat writer knows more than anybody, except maybe the team physician, and the guys have gone after them too.
Right. Now, of course they do. Now, speaking of that, if you are this beat writer who is gambling on the team and you have this inside information, you're still down to your bookie. Either you're really bad at betting or you have a really bad gambling problem. Because shouldn't that help
Exactly.
you?
There's a little bit of, well, again, you can only load up so much on one team.
Right.
And that's the problem with all gamblers is, at least all unprofessional gamblers, guys who just do it kind of for a lark, is they're not disciplined. They're not doing the 60, 70, 80 hours a week like some of these pros really are doing. They're not putting in that kind of time. And you make uninformed bets. I mean, many pros will just stick to, I just do baseball or I just do football or whatever. They have a specialty and they do it. Whereas most regular Joe gamblers, I'm going to bet the NFL games this weekend. Maybe I'll bet some college games once basketball starts up. Oh, I think, the Heat are going to win tonight. And that's how they get themselves in trouble.
So what's the best percent for that professional sharp gambler? Like, this is my life, this is my livelihood, this is what I do. What's like the best percentage that a guy like that, or a woman, let's not be sexist here, can hope to win over time?
Well, if you want to believe the gambling touts out there who say I hit 70, 80% of my bets all the time, call my 1-800 number now and get tonight's, Monday Night Football game for free, and those type of guys, they're lying to you, by the way.
Yeah. What about the real gamblers? Not those guys. Those guys are scam artists.
The real dudes, honestly, they're happy if they hit 58% of their games when you're talking about the NFL or the NBA. 58%. That'll make them more than profitable. Really, I think to be profitable, you have to hit something like 52.8% of the games to basically break even. Anything above that's gravy, which
So.
seems like nothing. You're like, geez, you think you could predict the outcome of a coin flip 52% of the time.
So
But the fact is, you can't.
somebody out there is hitting like 65, 70, 75%. These like you said, these like telephone tout guy numbers. If someone's really hitting those, that person's probably fixing games, right?
Well, it's something suspect, that's for sure. Something's very, very suspect because it can't be done. I mean, these pro gamblers, they prove it all the time that it really can't be done. You can go on streaks. I mean, don't get me wrong, these guys sometimes go on incredible streaks, but after the huge winning streak, often comes a huge losing streak on top of it. So over the long haul, we're talking, like I say, about anything between 53 and 58% of the time you win, you're making good money. But it never gets to that 60% mark, not over the long time.
So, like we said, to get to that mark, fix is probably in. You have a whole chapter in the book dedicated to international game fixing, like some of the tennis stuff we already talked about. But two things really stood out to me. One was, wow, is international soccer just a villainous hive of wretched match fixing? That's a Star Wars reference, by the
Oh,
way.
I got it. I'm right with you there.
But it is. International soccer seems to be like the most isolated cantina of sports. And then sec I mean, you've got minor European, Chinese leagues, every league you could think of, and you have World Cup matches being fixed in
I know.
2006, not even like 50 years ago, in 2006. So What is it about soccer that makes it so attractive, and how bad is the problem?
The problem is horrific. I mean, like you point out, I mean, it's everywhere in soccer. In fact, just I think 2 days ago, they arrested 10 guys in Australia for fixing matches. I mean, it's going on now, and it's going on in every country. And that's the big thing I argue about with larceny games is, we could see soccer being corrupt, tennis being corrupt, cricket being corrupt all over the world, but supposedly this will never happen in the United States. It never can happen in the United States.
Well, we're the exceptional nation, you know that, right?
Well, true. But I mean, but that's the big lie. I mean, it's somehow that, we're above this, and we're one of the most corrupt, nations in the world, for
Well,
crying out loud. How
hold
can
on there, Vladimir Putin. Hold on a second. If you want to say that, you're going to have to write a New York Times op-ed.
Okay, I'll do that later. I'll do that, I promise.
But so what? But is it?
But going back to soccer,
yeah.
Yeah,
why is
I
it
don't know
attractive?
why it's so picked upon. I guess it's because it's everywhere. Everybody gambles on it in the world besides us, apparently. And the scary thing for me with soccer is I don't see how you can fix it. I mean, I can kind of understand a football game and a basketball game, but I don't see how you fix those little guys running around on the field, with all 11 of them. But the amazing thing with these fixers is they could not only fix a match, they could say, I want the game to end 3-1, and the game will end 3-1.
And this is documented. Like, this has actually happened.
Yes. Yeah. This is not make-believe stuff. This is true, honest-to-goodness stuff. Like you say, the World Cup, matches in the World Cup have been fixed. Matches in the Olympics have been fixed. But yet we don't think you can fix a regular NBA game or a regular NFL game. Come on, people, wake up. This is going on everywhere in the nation, everywhere in the world, I should say. And in Europe, they're getting serious about it. I mean, they're having huge meetings, and they're trying to figure out a way how to save the sport of soccer from this. That's how bad it is.
So when you've got all this international match fixing, and like we talked about that worldwide trillion-dollar number, and as you talk about in the book, you've got these crime syndicates, just like the organized crime here in the U.S., you've got these international crime syndicates involved, especially it seems like in Asia. Is there any chance that those international gamblers and criminals try to start fixing matches here in the U.S.? Like you said, it could come, not that there's any fixing or gambling going on here, it's illegal, but that the international money and fixing could actually decide, you know what, let's target some U.S. sports too.
Well, Major League Soccer is already concerned about it. They're concerned about the fact. And one of the reasons the soccer guys are so successful in doing what they do is they find the guys from the third world countries.
Mm-hmm.
And many times those guys will still wind up in, the English Premier League and other big leagues around the world. But yet the criminals who fix these matches have gotten their hooks into these guys back when they're like 15, 16 years old. And it's kind of like how you maybe, can basically corrupt a college kid and work them all the way into the NFL or into the NBA. That's what they're doing with soccer. They're getting these guys young and they're corrupting them then. And then they wind up, like I say, in Major League Soccer. And then they use them to their advantage.
So if you were...
I mean, Major League Soccer is already worried about this and already looking at the United States. The other thing I found is the fact that even though I don't think the FBI really investigates game fixing anymore, I did find one thing in a file where it said they have turned over all match fixing or all sports bribery investigations over to their Asian Organized Crime Unit.
Interesting.
Which is very interesting because that's where most of the fixing is going on and soccer is coming out of Asia.
Wow. So if I was, the way you describe it, if I was an Asian crime syndicate, which I will never be, by the way, but let's just pretend here.
You could join one, though.
I don't know if I want to get that many tattoos. I saw that movie with Michael Douglas, Black Rain. Again, this is an old reference for some of you. I don't want those Yakuza tattoos. I could do without that, but I'm a wimp. I don't want the needle near me, but let's get back to the pretend scenario here. So I am an Asian crime syndicate fixer at this point. So if I wanted to try to start fixing MLB, NBA, NFL, I want to get my hooks into these guys while they're still in college. Or maybe I want to go down to Dominican Republic, get my hooks into some of these baseball players while they're still 14, 15, 16 in those academies.
Yeah, you got it. That's exactly.
Or maybe in the minor leagues.
Exactly.
That's where they're most vulnerable, before they have money and have more ability to say no.
Well, and you think about, unfortunately, you think about sports in the United States today, especially, the big baseball, football, basketball, is, these kids, they're really getting corrupted in middle school. I mean, they're learning how a system works because they're good at sports, and they get special treatment in middle school, and then they get into high school and they get even more special treatment. And then they're getting recruited by colleges who are throwing them money under the table, and like the whole Oklahoma State story, giving them drugs and women and whatever else they want to get them to come and play at their school. And then, you know, the agents are approaching them in their junior and senior year to get them into the pros. I mean, these kids are being corrupted from the time they're 12, and all they know is corruption until they get into the pros. So if a gambler's doing the same thing, why should it surprise anybody? I mean, why would it throw you off? I mean, this is what these people do, and they do it for a living. These soccer fixers.
Well, let me flip this around on you. Because modern pro players, at least in America, for the most part, not every sport, not every player, not every contract, but for the most part, and especially with the guys who would have the most ability on the field in theory to affect the outcome of a game, you know, not like the third string, you know, backup punter, well, there's no third string punter, but the third string, you know, backup offensive lineman or something, or quarterback, right? The guy who doesn't even dress, the ball cap guy. But you know, the actual starting quarterback, the starting center, the starting point guard, you know, except the starting pitcher, those guys, in general, they make really good livings, tons of money at this point, almost so much that it doesn't seem like bribing them to shave points or fix a game would work. It's just not enough incentive. Is there any way, if you're a fixer, that you can still get to these guys at this point?
Well, remember Patrick Ewing's famous quote? Yeah, we make a lot of money, but we spend a lot of money, too.
So you think these guys are just... you want to look for like a guy like Antoine Walker that's just blowing all his money. Oh, on gambling, by the way, who should know.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, is I think really game fixing is a crime of opportunity. Obviously, you can't necessarily go to a Peyton Manning and think you're going to corrupt him into fixing a game. But if you find a guy like Peyton Manning who maybe has a cocaine problem or maybe has a gambling problem of his own, and that, you know, $50 million he supposedly made is gone, he spent it because of his problems, well, then you can get your hooks into a guy like that, especially if you're the bookie or you're the organized crime guy he's betting through or getting his drugs from or what have you. Then you have that opportunity, you have that in with the guy. And the mob, let's face it, for 100 years or more, has made their living on finding people's weaknesses and exploiting them. That's what they do.
That's a really good point. You're right. They're very good at that. They've got a lot of experience. They've got a lot of time and a lot of, as they say, institutional knowledge and memory of how to do that.
Well, and that's the thing I don't think even people consider is that, you know, even these guys who are supposed to be making a lot of money aren't making a lot of money. I mean, a couple of years ago, you had Arian Foster and Matt Forte. They were the number one running backs on their team, but neither one of them was making, I think, $500,000 a season. And then once you take out the taxes, once you take out the agent management fee, once you take out, you know, the crooked investment banker who's investing their money, and once they buy their house and their cars and all that, that money's gone. Gone. So if you've got a guy who's gotten in with one of these type of players and says, look, you supposedly made 500 grand this year, but really you only cleared about 150. How about I give you 200 grand and your team's 2-13 and this week you don't do so well and you can make more than your salary in one game by not doing so well and nobody will know about it because I can bet a couple $1 million on this game, which nobody can see because it's all unmonitored across the United States and I can spread my money around and we'll all profit wonderfully.
Yeah.
It's a pretty tempting offer. It's a pretty easy offer to make.
I mean, that sounds pretty
plausible.
And
that's the number one guy.
Yeah, that sounds pretty plausible. We promised FBI files at the start of this. We're running towards the end of things. So let's go quickly through a couple of things. Those American FBI files, you know, let's move away from the international stuff. Let's stick with America like we have been. First one, Mickey Mantle. The FBI was keeping a file on him, which I had no idea. You tell us. What did they find, and in any way, how would what they found made him vulnerable to this kind of fixing we're talking about?
Well, poor Mick seemed to be a bit of a scumbag. Nothing against the guy, rest his soul and all. But Mick, apparently, not only did he like drinking, but he apparently loved women, and he loved women so much that the mob was providing him with prostitutes in basically every city he visited while on the road.
Okay, see, the liking women part's fine, the drinking we knew about, but the mob supplying prostitutes is another level here that would make someone vulnerable.
It's an extremely big level, yeah, and that's the exact type of thing. So the mob supplies him with prostitutes. One night they take a couple of incriminating photos of Mick in bed with a couple of women, and then they approach Mick and go, "Hey, Mick, do you want these in the New York Times tomorrow, or maybe you don't do so well tomorrow
Do
in the
we
game?"
have an idea why the mob was supplying him with prostitutes? Did the FBI get to the bottom of that part?
No, I think what it is a lot of times, because the mob was really tight with Joe DiMaggio too, actually even more tight with Joel than they were to Mick. I think a lot of these guys, a lot of mobsters like being seen with professional athletes and with, entertainment people and movie stars
Yeah.
and that sort of thing.
It was a
Just to kind
hangout
of,
thing.
yeah, it was just kind of to promote their image and look how cool I am type of thing. And so that's probably how, they got in tight with Mick.
So in theory, maybe they just want to hang out, they wanted to party. It wasn't like they were looking to, maybe they were fans of Mickey Mantle. I don't know. I don't know who
Yeah, it
mobsters root
could very
for.
well be, yeah. But that's the end.
But
See,
that
that's all the mob
association's
needed.
right. The association is still fishy. Let's move to basketball. The FBI, it seemed like, had a very large file on Wilt Chamberlain. You look
Yeah.
through it. What does it tell us? What's fishy in there? What do you, after digesting it, what's your take? What should we know about that?
In my opinion, Will Chamberlain should be kicked out of the Hall of Fame tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Because the
Why?
FBI had very, very, very credible evidence that he was gambling on NBA games in which he played. Even though he was gambling on himself. Wilt was a pretty smart dude. He was gambling on himself to win, which is why the FBI actually dropped their investigation into him, because it wasn't a violation of the Sports Bribery Act for Wilt Chamberlain to be betting on Wilt Chamberlain.
Right, so he wasn't bribing himself to play better.
Exactly. And he wasn't necessarily betting, he wasn't betting against himself either. Just like Paul Hornung with the Packers, he was supposedly just betting on himself.
So you don't.
And Pete
So.
Rose was supposedly just betting on himself.
Well.
But the fact is, Wilt was doing it, and Wilt should no longer be a Hall of Famer because of it.
Right, even though it was, I'm Wilt Chamberlain, I'm going to go out and kick butt. And you know what? I'll pull extra on that because I'm so confident in my ability to kick butt. That's basically, it
And he
sounds like
was,
what's going on.
yeah, and he was betting like $10,000 to $12,000 a game,
That was a
which
lot
is,
back then.
not, that's a lot in the late '60s, definitely.
So, sticking with the NBA, we promised this earlier. New York Post reported over the weekend, and I feel like they reported after reading your book
Oh, they
that,
did.
according to FBI files, members of the early 80s New York Knicks, shaving points, giving away inside information, and this was a favor to their cocaine dealer. What is the full story there? And since you couldn't figure out the names necessarily, how credible do you think this FBI information is?
Well, the thing with all the files in this book of mine is they were all very credible information. Because from talking to the FBI agents, I learned that they don't open a file unless they really believe there's something there. So, I mean, there's probably a lot of rumors, a lot of innuendos, a lot of games that might have been fixed or potentially fixed that the FBI just threw aside because they didn't find the original source of the information credible. Okay. But for this case, obviously they found it credible. They investigated it. They actually followed it for about 4 years.
4 years.
Yeah, so they put a lot of time and effort
Okay, so
into
they
this.
definitely thought something was going on. Yeah, FBI agents
Exactly.
don't waste their time.
No. And we know historically, not that Michael Ray Richardson was one of these guys investigated by the FBI, I don't know that. But we know historically that he got kicked out of the NBA because of drug tech, because of positive drug tests, and that was drug tests for cocaine.
Right, and we know historically that period in NBA history was
Was
rife
rife
with
with
cocaine.
cocaine.
As in defense of the NBA, as America was too.
Exactly. And it wasn't the NFL, the Major League Baseball, they all had issues.
Right. Oh,
But the thing
baseball
with
had
this.
huge issues, for sure.
Oh,
There was
yeah.
all that stuff with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Yeah. So I mean, no, it was sports in that case was reflecting society at large. I mean,
Oh,
that
totally.
was Miami Vice was on TV soon after that. So
The
what
thing
else do you need to
that.
know?
Yeah. The thing that blew my mind with the New York Knicks case was the fact that the way it ended is after all this time, after all the effort they put in and all the credible information they seem to have, where like this cocaine dealer went from betting $300 a game to betting $10,000 a game and winning because he was betting against the Knicks. I mean, that alone is a huge red flag in my book.
Yeah.
The weird thing is the FBI apparently interviewed, and I think it's the cocaine dealer. It's hard to tell because of the redactions, but they interviewed somebody like him, and the cocaine dealer basically said, "I don't know anybody on the Knicks. I never dealt with them. I have no idea what you're talking about." And the FBI dropped it. That was it. They interviewed one dude. They never interviewed from the file that I can tell, they never interviewed anybody in the Knicks. None of the players suspected. They never told the Knicks this was going on, apparently. They never told the NBA this was going on. And yet they interview one guy, the guy denies everything, and the FBI goes, okay, and close the file.
They spent 4 years for that? Why?
That's the strange part. I some of these files, you just can't understand why they just end the way they end. But that's the way this one turns out.
Well, that'll make you believe in conspiracy theories. I'll tell you that much.
Totally.
We got time for two more questions here. So let's quickly hit the NFL. Now, you talked to Dan Moldea, someone I've talked to in the past as well, old school investigative reporter. He wrote the definitive book on Jimmy Hoffa, knows organized crime. He also wrote the 1989 book, Interference, How Organized Crime Influences Professional Football. And in that book, he lays out evidence for 70 NFL games being fixed between 1951 and 1979. As you mentioned earlier, the NFL says no games have ever been fixed. Now, you looked over these FBI files. You talked to Moldea directly. You think his number's accurate?
Oh, easily. I'm pretty certain that he did his homework. I mean, that poor guy, according to him, he got, devastated by the NFL. The NFL wrecked his career, took his knees out from under him because of writing that book. But I think many of the things that are in Interference, I kind of found the FBI files related to.
Okay.
So, I mean, kind of corroborating evidence toward what he did. But, I mean, Dan was lucky enough, and he had the contacts within law enforcement and even within the underworld to actually interview some of the guys who did the fixing. I mean, he interviewed Dice Dawson, one of the gamblers who was connected to guys like Len Dawson and Bobby Lane, and Dice Dawson told me, I fixed at least 32 NFL games myself.
32? One guy.
And that was at least, his recollection wasn't, exactly positive. He's like, I think there was a few in there, with him and a couple of him. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, I totally believe what Moldea did. And, I mean, in a very real way, he was kind of my influence for what I did now with larceny games.
Well,
hey, no one else will touch this subject.
Let's go out on a final question. One that I want to know what you think, and maybe some of the – I know you talked to quite a few gamblers. You talked to former FBI agents, former NFL security. You talked to a lot of people for this book.
Yeah, I tried to. I tried to make it as thorough as I could.
Right.
And not everybody would talk to me. Not everybody would go on the record. And a lot of people told me stuff that I wish I could tell other people because it would blow your mind.
Well, we could do a second podcast if you want to just lay it all out. I can't protect you from libel suits, but I can give you a forum to talk about it.
It wouldn't be the libel suits. It would be the bullet in the back of the head that worried me more.
Ooh. Okay, well, we won't do that. But last question. Your opinion, based on all the reporting you did, based on what you've read, you think the potential for game fixing, for spot fixing, for, as you call it, larceny games, you think it's bigger or smaller if sports gambling is legalized in this country?
I think it gets very, very small if it's legalized.
Why? All the leagues argue the opposite.
Because the leagues are lying to you, without a doubt. The reason we know about, they just had that report, earlier this year from Europol, where 680 matches in soccer had likely been fixed in the past, I forget what it was, 5 or 10 years. And the reason they know about all of those matches is because of legalized gambling in Europe. Because what happens is, what Las Vegas claims to do today really goes on in Europe. They see suspicious odds, they see strange money showing up, and that money comes out ahead all the time. They investigate it. They give it over to the authorities, they follow the money, and many times it's led to fixed games. In the United States, that doesn't happen because no one's monitoring the money. It's all in organized crimes control. And organized crimes are not about to go to the FBI and say, hey, I think this game was kind of fishy. Okay,
right.
That's out the window. But you legalize it, you make it legal over the United States, then you can monitor all these billions of dollars being bet. You can see who's betting. You can see how much the odds are changing, what the point spreads are, who's betting where and what. And suddenly then you can follow the money, and when something suspicious occurs, you can investigate it. And
so,
that's what the leagues fear. That's what the leagues are afraid of, is that someone else besides them will actually be watching all of this. Because then they know, because they know games are being fixed. They know things are being influenced. But no one else is looking for it. Sports media is not, the FBI is not, the gaming industry isn't. So why does the NFL have to investigate itself if no one else is doing their job? But if it's made legal, then someone will be doing that job, and the NFL can't hide.
Okay, that was spoken like a true sports conspiriologist.
Thank you.
Actually, no, but actually, it's actually really logical. It's almost so logical that I think it will never happen. But, and also, I think in a weird way, you just made an analogous argument as to why performance-enhancing drug use should be legalized and monitored as well. But that's for a totally different podcast. For now, we are pretty much out of time. Before we go, the book again is Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. It's by Brian Toohey. Brian, tell people how they can follow you on Twitter.
I am at The Fix Is In Toohey, which is Toohy, at Twitter. I'm on Facebook at the same address, and I have two websites, thefixisin.net and larcenygames.com.
Good stuff. Really enjoy this. This is probably one of my favorite, if not my favorite, podcast so far.
I know it's your favorite.
And definitely hope to have you back on again in the future. For now, I'm Patrick Ruby for Sports on Earth. This has been the Ruby Tuesday podcast. And as always, I'm saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.